name is Emily Putnam Hornstein, and I'm a research associate at the Center for Social Services Research at the University of California at Berkeley. Today, I will be providing a brief overview of an article published in Child Maltreatment entitled Report of Maltreatment as a Risk Factor for Injury Death, a Prospective Birth Cohort Study. Before beginning, I'd like to thank the California Department of Social Services for access to the Child Protective Service records I used in the study, as well as the California Department of Public Health for access to vital birth and death records. Although I don't have any co-authors on this paper, I'd like to acknowledge Barbara Nidell, Joe Magruder, Daniel Webster, Bill Dawson, Debbie Williams, Greg Rose, and other colleagues from both the Center for Social Services Research and the California Department of Social Services, without whom this research would not have been possible. I'd also like to thank the Harry Frank Guggenheim Foundation, the Fosbeck Foundation, and the Center for Child and Youth Policy for providing funding for this study. So this study arises from my desire to better understand those children who are reported to Child Protective Service agencies or child welfare agencies for possible maltreatment. And by maltreatment, I'm including physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, and the most common form of maltreatment, which is child neglect. And I was interested in understanding these children not just relative to one another in terms of how children reported for physical abuse may be different than children reported for neglect, but also how these children compare with children in the general population who may share some of the same risk factors for maltreatment but are not reported to Child Protective Services. Abused and neglected children are commonly analogized to an iceberg, in the sense that those child victims who come to the attention of public child protective service agencies represent that small tip of the iceberg that emerges above the water, while a much larger population of maltreated children remain below the water's surface. And running with this analogy, what we don't know is how the population of children who are maltreated or at risk of maltreatment and are unknown to Child Protective Service agencies differ from those who are known. In other words, we don't know if those who are reported represent a representative or a biased sample of children who are truly at risk. And in reviewing the empirical research, there's been much debate as to whether children who are reported to Child Protective Service agencies are reported simply because they are poor and because of their poverty, come in contact with a greater number of mandated reporters through their receipt of public services, or if these children who are reported are truly at greater risk of harm than other children who have not been reported. Most research studies to date have focused by necessity on that small tip of the iceberg, examining only the characteristics of those children who are reported to Child Protective Services for abuse or neglect. But for obvious reasons, these data in isolation are extremely limited. Beyond the fact that CPS data capture only those children who are officially reported for possible maltreatment, these data also suffer from the notable limitations of containing a very restricted set of variables. Most of the data that Child Protective Service agencies collect involves various management tasks, case management tasks, and so they're often missing the more descriptive case characteristics, including family-level variables. And also missing from the Child Protective Service data is information concerning etiological risk factors that may predate that first contact with Child Protective Services or outcomes following contact with Child Protective Services that could be used to assess the decisions that were made surrounding the child and family risk. Therefore, my objective in the current study was to better understand those children who are reported for maltreatment by studying them in the context of the full population of children in California. And to do this, I created a unique data set linking three independent sources of data concerning children in California. I started by obtaining all of the state's birth records from the California Department of Public Health. And this gave me information on all children who were born in California between 1999 and 2006. And by using these birth records, I was able to track all of these children through the age of 5 or January 1, 2008, which was kind of the study end date, whichever came first. This birth data provided me with universally collected data on risk and protective factors that were present for all of the children at birth, things like whether or not the child was born low birth weight, the mother's level of education, and whether or not the child was covered by public health insurance. I then linked these birth records to the state's death records, which were also from the California Department of Public Health. And the death records provided me with a measure of what I would kind of consider the most basic measure of an absence of child well-being. In other words, a child's death before the age of 5. I then also linked these birth records with the state's Child Protective Service records, which were available from the California Department of Social Services. And that way, what I could do is look at all of the children who were born in California, figure out how many had died from what could be considered a preventable injury death, and how many of those children had been previously reported to Child Protective Services, suggesting that the child had been earlier identified as someone who is at risk of harm. So in this sense, I kind of conceptualized the linkages with the death records as kind of providing this population-based indicator of child harm and unrealized child welfare service needs. That could be looked at for both those children who were and were not referred to Child Protective Services. I'm going to say just a bit about the linkage methodology, which is that I established child-level linkages across these three data sources. And what that allowed me to do was capture for a given child the information from the birth, the Child Protective Service, and the death record. I should note that these linkages were only possible because of technological advances in computing. So it used to be that although we had all of this administrative agency data, it was not used for research purposes because it existed only in paper form. Obviously, with computers now, most social service delivery systems maintain their case records electronically. And because of computing advances, what that means is that we not only have these standalone data systems, but we have the technology that will allow us to link client records across agencies and across data collection systems. So as you can imagine, that means that information for an individual client can be vastly extended by capturing information for that same client in other databases, allowing that much more to be gleaned about their characteristics, their service needs, what services they received, et cetera. And to kind of construct this unique data set where I had the records linked across these three data systems, what I used was a probabilistic matching algorithm. And I won't go into the details of that, but suffice it to say that if you have something, a unique client identifier such as a social security number that's common across all three data systems, it ends up being a relatively easy means of matching that client across those three data systems. In the case of this research, there was no such unique identifier. And so by using probabilistic strategies, it didn't require that there be one identifier. It allowed me to use a number of different non-unique identifiers, things like the child's first name, child's date of birth, maternal first and last name, et cetera. And what probabilistic matching does is it uses a statistical model to compute a kind of a numerical value which captures how similar two records are based on how many matching fields agree or disagree for a specified set of match variables. And using this probabilistic methodology, I was able to link 98% of child death records from 1999 through 2007, child death records for children who died before the age of 5, to a birth record. And I was able to link 86% of Child Protective Service records from that same time period, from 1999 through 2007, to a birth record. I should note that the high rate of birth-to-death linkages, that 98%, is largely because most children who die before the age of 5 die during the first 30 days of life. And so the California Department of Public Health already had a kind of a linkage identifier variable on that birth record for children who had died during the first year of life. The 14% of Child Protective Service records where I was not able to match those children to a birth record reflect both missed matches because often there was not enough information in the Child Protective Service record to successfully identify that child in the birth record data, and also reflected children who may have been born outside of California but subsequently moved to the state where they were reported for maltreatment, and those children are not included. So the final data set captures information on over 4 million children who were born in California between 1999 and 2006, and it includes maltreatment allegation information for 500,000 children who were reported to CPS or Child Protective Services. And it also includes death data on the 2,000 children who were fatally injured before the age of five. I should say that I needed to include the 8 cohorts of children born in California and work with that massive 4.3 million number, because to conduct a multivariate analysis, or an analysis in which I could make adjustments for other risk factors such as poverty and child health, which are associated with both a child's risk of being reported for maltreatment and a child's risk of injury death. The ability to control for those other risk factors meant that I could examine a prior report of maltreatment as an independent risk factor for injury death. And although injuries are the leading cause of death among children, the overall rate of injury death in the population is relatively low, as is the rate of children reported to Child Protective Service agencies for maltreatment. And so I needed to have that large number. This is actually the first study that has been able to prospectively examine injury death as an outcome following a report of maltreatment in the context of a multivariate analysis for exactly that reason. California, Florida, Texas, there are only a handful of states where we would have enough children to overcome those low base rate issues. Therefore, this study was undertaken with the objective of answering two basic and yet, again, for those base rate issues, previously unanswered questions. The first question was simply, is a non-fatal allegation of maltreatment an independent risk factor for injury mortality? And the second question was, does the risk associated with a prior allegation of maltreatment vary by manner of injury death? And by manner of injury death, I mean whether or not the injury fatality was determined to be an unintentional injury death as opposed to an intentional or inflicted injury death. As I mentioned earlier, I'm kind of conceptualizing this non-fatal report of maltreatment as an indicator of one or more prior occasions in which the child was either harmed and therefore reported to Child Protective Services or at risk of harm. And as such, this indicator, I'm assuming, would capture a variety of unmeasured child, family, and other environmental factors that might be predictive of future harm. So my hypothesis going into this research was that after controlling for sociodemographic differences at birth, the likelihood of sustaining a fatal injury, either unintentional or intentional, would be elevated for those children who had previously been reported to Child Protective Services. And I should add that I chose to examine both unintentional and intentional injury fatalities based on my review of the literature, which although originating kind of from two separate sources, so there's been this empirical stream of unintentional injury literature and a separate stream of intentional injury literature, my read suggests that both unintentional and intentional injuries occurring during those early childhood years are not random, and in almost all cases, the injury fatalities are largely preventable. I also found that regardless of the intent, even those injuries that are declared unintentional, those frequently occur in the context of some broader pattern of parenting where, even if it's not criminally negligent, there's still some exposure of the child to an age-inappropriate risk. And the literature would also suggest that a significant proportion of intentionally inflicted injuries are misclassified as unintentional. So for me, the distinction, you know, was the injury fatality intentional or unintentional was secondary. It was really, was there an injury fatality? I found that prior non-fatal report to Child Protective Services was the strongest predictor of a child's injury death during the first 5 years of life. Children who'd previously been reported for maltreatment died of injuries at over 4 times the rate of children in the general population who had never been reported. And then after adjusting for differences between children reported for maltreatment and those in the general population, so we know that children who are reported for maltreatment tend to come from more disadvantaged families in terms of poverty, education, et cetera. So what I was able to do was include all of those risk factors present at birth. I included the child's gender, whether or not the child had been born low birth weight or had a birth abnormality. I included what the birth payment method was, whether it was public health insurance or private health insurance, maternal age, maternal education, race, birth order, whether or not paternity was established on the birth record. So I was able to kind of control for all those differences between children who are not reported and children who are reported. And I found that those risk factors did explain some of the elevated risk of injury death faced by children reported for maltreatment. But even after adjusting for all of those risk factors, children with a prior report of maltreatment still died of injuries at over 2.5 times the rate of other sociodemographically similar children who had never been reported for maltreatment. I then ran separate models. So what I wanted to do was look at whether or not a prior report of maltreatment is a risk factor for overall injury death. And then what I did is I ran separate models so I could look at whether it was an independent risk factor for both unintentional or accidental injuries as well as intentional or inflicted injuries. And what I found was that when I modeled only those accidental or unintentional injuries, after controlling for all of those risk factors at birth that I mentioned, children who'd been previously reported for maltreatment continued to die at a rate that was over 2 times greater than sociodemographically similar children who had not been reported. And when I looked at only inflicted or intentional injuries and I controlled for all of the differences in risk, I found that a prior allegation of maltreatment was associated with a rate of death that was over 5.5 times the rate of death observed among children who had not been reported. So those are the key findings, and I want to kind of highlight 4 points that I consider to be the important takeaways from this article. The first is that these data and this analysis underscore that, at least in California, a child's report to Child Protective Services for maltreatment is not random, and it's not simply a function of poverty. The report to Child Protective Services signals a level of risk, including a risk of death, that is greater than sociodemographic risk factors alone would predict. Even after adjusting for all of those other risk factors, I found that children reported for maltreatment died of injuries at significantly higher rates than children who had never been reported. I should point out that the Child Protection Service system will never be able to prevent all child deaths. And I think most listeners are well aware of trading off type 1 versus type 2 errors. At the same time, the heightened risk of injury death faced by children with that prior allegation of maltreatment is both disturbing as well as telling. Infants and toddlers reported to Child Protective Services clearly face threats that run deeper than poverty alone would indicate. And although on an absolute basis, very few children who are reported to Child Protective Services are fatally injured before the age of 5, in this study it amounted to less than 1% of the over 500,000 children who were reported. Death is in kind of public health literature is frequently employed as a marker of population level differences in well-being. And on a relative basis, there is little doubt that these children who have been referred for maltreatment face a significantly heightened risk of death and a significantly reduced state of well-being. The second point that I want to make is that the finding that a prior allegation of maltreatment is the single greatest predictor of not just an intentional or inflicted injury death, but also an unintentional or accidental injury death. And this finding is consistent with either of 2 possible interpretations. The first is that this heightened risk reflects a high level of parental culpability and unintentional injury fatalities involving young children. And this would make sense given that the strongest risk factor for an unintentional death was the child's earlier identification as a child who had either been maltreated or was at risk of maltreatment. So I'd say it stands to reason that these unintentional fatalities stem from an absence of kind of that age-appropriate supervision I mentioned, or caregiving that falls somewhere along a neglect spectrum of parental supervision. The alternative interpretation is that the association between a prior allegation of maltreatment and unintentional injury death is nothing more than an artifact of misclassified deaths and coroner's inability to correctly ascertain maltreatment-related fatalities. And as I mentioned earlier, there is a large body of literature which would suggest that we severely undercount those deaths that are truly maltreatment related. And so that may be what we're observing here. But either way, these findings, I would argue, lend support to researchers who have called for child protective services to be pursued under a more of a public health oriented agenda focused on the prevention of all manners of injury death, keeping in mind that the fatality is the same, whether it's declared intentional or unintentional, the end result is the same. The child has died. The third point I want to make is that this study, this is something I haven't mentioned yet, this study found that 20% of children who died from injuries had been previously reported to Child Protective Services. And the fraction of children with prior CPS contact rose to 33% when only intentional injury deaths were considered. These numbers fall within what I would argue is a fairly wide range of cross-sectional estimates in which researchers have attempted to estimate the proportion of intentional injury victims who had a history of Child Protective Service contact. I would just note that the proportions reported in this study should be considered fairly conservative estimates of the fraction of children which some protective action might have been taken, given that this analysis focuses only on whether a child had been previously reported to Child Protective Services and does not capture family-level contacts that may have involved older siblings. I would also add that in addition to the children in this study who had a non-fatal allegation of maltreatment prior to their death, there were an additional 591 children who were first reported to Child Protective Services either on or after the date of the injury event or date of death. And so if I kind of rework the numbers, what that means is that a full 51% of all fatal injury victims under the age of 5 either had a prior non-fatal report of maltreatment or died from injuries in which the circumstances of the injury event were deemed suspicious enough to warrant a report to Child Protective Services after the child's death. And I find that number to be striking and something to give some thought to. And then the final point I want to make before closing is that, and this is not an empirical finding, but I simply wish to highlight that in my mind, this study is an example of the knowledge that can be generated by linking Child Protective Services data with other social service delivery systems. Linkages with vital birth and death record variables were used to generate child and family level information for each child who'd been reported, information that was either missing from the Child Protective Service data system, predated contact with Child Protective Services, or amounted to an outcome that followed Child Protective Service contact, and information that we did not have and we would not have if looking only at that Child Protective Service data. I'm currently conducting some additional research that will not only examine possible variations in the risk of injury death by the allegation type, so looking at if there are differences for children who are reported for physical abuse as opposed to neglect or sexual abuse, differences based on the services that are offered, as well as some additional linkages with population level emergency department and hospitalization data, which will allow me to look at non-fatal injuries that may lead to or follow contact with Child Protective Services. And in terms of tracking the prevalence of child maltreatment, the idea is that we are able to hopefully identify high-risk subsets of children who may be in need of services and evaluate intervention efforts. And yet both of those require linkages with population-based data and other social service delivery systems. The administrative child welfare data as kind of a standalone system won't provide us with the information that we need. So my hope is that in addition to generating new information about those children who've been reported, that as the findings from this study are disseminated, we'll see kind of greater interest in longer-term data sharing agreements between social service agencies serving children and families, as well as more researchers who recognize and are interested in linking this kind of agency data across delivery systems. Okay, that concludes this podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you to Sage for hosting. I hope this information proved useful, and I would encourage listeners to email me should they have any questions or comments. Thank you.